I've had dreams that weren't just dreams.
We accept the reality of the world with which we're presented. It's as simple as that.
Billions of people just living out their lives. Oblivious.
They taught you good. Made you believe their world.
What is real? How do you define real? If you're talking about what you can feel, what you can smell, what you can taste and see, then real is simply electrical signals interpreted by your brain.
Hello and welcome to Beyond the Paradigm. I'm your host, Paul Breckell. Thank you to all my regular listeners who keep coming back week after week. It's really encouraging to see the numbers of listeners going up week in and week out. And if you are one of those regular listeners, can I ask you to do something for me? Can I ask you, if you're not already following the show, to first of all follow the show and then leave me a 5-star rating, as leaving the rating helps me become more visible and will make it easier for people to find my show when they're looking for something to listen to. And secondly, if you are a regular listener and you've been listening for a while, could I ask you if you would offer financial support for the show? Because like I've said previously, there are costs incurred and you can become a patron of the show at patreon.com/beyondtheparadigm, and there you can sign up to become a member where you will acquire voting rights in order to vote on what topics you want on the show. You will get a shout out on air and you will keep this show on air by supporting the show. Secondly, you can just make a one-off donation. You can go to buymeacoffee.com/beyondthep5 and there just make a one-off donation if you can't afford a regular monthly donation. And like I've said previously, I am going to start to offer other tiers which will have other benefits, including member-only episodes and member chats with myself and other members. And that's coming in the future. But I'll drop all the links, as usual, in the show description. And also, could I ask you if you could support me on Twitter by following me on Twitter? I'm trying to build my Twitter followership up there, Paradigm_79. And I'm also on Instagram at Paradigm1979. And it would be very much appreciated if you connect with me on there. You can send me messages. You can look at some of the posts I put on there. You can communicate with me that way as well. And you can also communicate with me via email at beyondtheparadigm@yahoo.com. So today I've got with me a guest, Vicky Joy Anderson. And Vicky Joy is an author, a researcher, a speaker and a poet. And she's wrote a book called The Only Come Out at Night. And it's a book that's about sleep paralysis. Now, sleep paralysis, I did my first ever episode on this. But in this episode, we go into way more detail because Vicky Joy has been researching this topic herself for many years and has also experienced what the phenomena that we know as sleep paralysis. So I hope you enjoy this episode, guys. It is a mind-blowing episode. I also talk about my own personal experiences on it. So without further ado, I'm going to go and bring Vicky Joy onto the show. Welcome to the show, Vicky Joy Anderson. Thank you for joining me.
Hey, thanks, Paul. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, it's good to have you on. Just for the people who possibly don't know who you are, I know you've obviously done a lot of podcasts over the years and everything. You're the author of a book called The Only Come Out at Night, Exposing the Dark Weapon of Sleep Paralysis. I thought that was interesting when I looked at the cover that you call it a weapon. But for those who possibly may not have heard about the book and maybe not have listened to you before, could you just tell us a little bit about your background and what actually led you to write this book?
Yeah, absolutely. Well, I never intended or intentionally went about like, I'm going to write a book on sleep paralysis. And it must have just been the Lord's timing, because if ever there was a time to write a book on sleep paralysis, this is the time to do it. But I didn't have any of that in mind. There was nothing strategic about this on my behalf at all. The way it sort of organically happened is I wanted to be a writer since I was 10. And I ended up carrying that dream all the way into through high school, to the point that I even went to college to get a degree in writing because I wanted to be a writer. So that was always in place. I always knew that I wanted to write, but I never thought that I was going to be writing on fringy topics or conspiracies, even though that stuff was of interest to me. Back in the 70s and 80s, you kind of kept that sort of stuff quiet. Nowadays, the strongest consequence of being a conspiracy theorist is people have some socially engineered insults they'll throw at you. You'll maybe get a couple social media posts blocked or whatever. But back in the 50s, 60s, 70s, 80s, if you were too out of the closet with some of this stuff, the consequences were much more dire. You could lose friends, you could lose the respect of colleagues, you could lose your job, you could be deemed to have a mental illness, you could be locked away. There's a lots of people being relocated into facilities when they talked about this kind of stuff back in the day. So I was raised in a culture where I'm of a very Scandinavian background, and so we are a very stoic, private breed of people. Social media was a real stretch for me because it just went up against the upbringing of my parents and my grandparents, where you just didn't talk about stuff that was super personal. So this idea of going on social media and putting all your family photos and saying what you ate for dinner and all that, like that was just very outside of the bounds of the culture I was raised in. So what ended up happening was I dealt with sleep paralysis for close to 47 years off and on, and I spent most of that 47 years never having heard the phrase sleep paralysis, never having any understanding that anyone else had experienced this, believing it to be something spiritual, but really just thinking that it was a really heightened kind of a nightmare. It was probably tied to stress or anxiety in my life or unresolved trauma or something like that. And there, anytime you have tons and tons and tons of disturbed sleep and nightmares, you assume that there's some sort of physiological or mental issue there. And so it was something that I really didn't give any thought to until my late 30s, when I started to realize, because of the internet, that lots of people had experienced this. And when I figured out, or when I first discovered, that this bizarre, crazy, weird thing where I was even questioning my own sanity, or like, maybe am I just being melodramatic about this? It's just a bad dream. Not only to find out that other people experience this, but when they explain it, it's verbatim the exact same experience that I'm having. That's weird. Like, that's strange. And so you can talk to me all day long about scientific theories, medical theories. You can talk to me about narcolepsy and trauma and melatonin and all these different things, but you cannot explain to me, without having to get outside of the realms of the scientific method, you cannot explain to me why thousands of people of different genders, different ages, different cultural experiences over different centuries, you can't explain to me why we all are having the same experience when up to this point, we weren't online sharing this stuff. There's no way I could have known that people all over the world were experiencing this. And so, where my two worlds collided, this 40 plus year experience with sleep paralysis experiences and my desire to write, they collided one day. And I had been asked, I'd been commissioned to write an article about sleep paralysis on realdarknews.com. And I realized as I sat down to write that article that even though I had experienced it my entire life, I really didn't know what it was. And I didn't want to just copy and paste everything else that had already been written on it, because I had read all that stuff and I still didn't know what it was. So a lot of the stuff online, it's not helpful. If you're actually going through it, it's not that helpful. And so I realized that I couldn't even write an article on it. And it took me several weeks of prayer and fasting before I even got to the point where I could write a thousand word article on it. And once I wrote the article, I realized this is a massive can of worms. And this isn't something that people are going through because they, in every case, they dabbled with the occult or they tried psychedelics. You know, there's all these like cut and dry answers, these formulaic little answers as to why it happens. And I realize this is a much more, this is a way larger onion than we ever thought. The layers, I've been researching this now for 11 years, and I have not come to the end of this onion. Just when you start to peel off a layer, there's 20 more layers. That this onion is nowhere near being peeled of its layers. We're just now getting to just the tip of the iceberg of what this is, because now we do have this collective hive mind on the internet, and there's a lot of people using that for nefarious purposes. But where we can benefit from the collective is those of us who experience these things can get together now and share our stories and ask questions. And that's really what this is, Paul. I'm not like, hey, I wrote a book because I'm an expert. I wrote a book because I have an inquisitive mind. Why is this happening? Why is it happening to really godly people who didn't ask for it? Let's all get together and let's have a conversation. And maybe if there's 100 of us or 1,000 of us, and we're all looking at this through biblical lenses and through the lenses of our own experiences, maybe we can not only get to the bottom of this, but even better, what we want to do is we want to defeat the forces of evil. We want to unmask them. We want to expose the deeds of the devil. The very reason that the Son of Man came to earth was to expose and defeat the deeds of the devil. And we have an opportunity here in this to do that ourselves and to set captives free. And that's really why I wrote the
Well, it's a good reason as any. What a
book.
wonderful reason to write a book.
Yeah.
And it's interesting you mentioned there, obviously you talked about science and you have an excerpt from your book where you said, because science and the supernatural have undergone a bitter divorce, we modern folk now go to one facility to worship and pray, and we go to a different facility entirely to tend to our physical wounds and maladies. But this was not always so. In antiquity, the worlds of pathology and the paranormal were inextricably entwined. To sever the two now will only serve to keep both sides in the dark. And obviously, as we know, that's a tactic of the devil. And a lot of people are in the dark about this. And like I told you off air, obviously, I've experienced sleep paralysis, and you've said, obviously, there's so many people have experienced it. And like you mentioned, obviously, even it's clearly not being made up, because before the internet, people were experiencing it, and then they've come together and discovered that other people have had it. But what would you define sleep paralysis as? So you've done all your research and everything, you've experienced it. What would be the definition you would give to someone who doesn't know what it is?
Yeah. So I always have to preface this with a little bit of a disclaimer, so that we can have an intellectually honest discussion about it. Sleep paralysis is really a bad name for this. And I almost wonder if the person who originally came up with this title was intentionally sort of doing it to gaslight people. I don't think sleep paralysis started being used until the early 2000s, because if you go back into books that talk about the experience of it all the way up into the mid and late 1990s, you can find books and you can find occult books, you know, and astral projection and New Age books. You can't find a lot of Christian books, which is another reason why I wanted to write the book. If the only people who are telling the truth about this experience are occultists and Wiccans and New Agers, then Christians who experience this have nowhere to go but the world to figure out what's happening to them. And of course, they're not going to get necessarily biblical or satisfying answers for it. And so, what's interesting though is if you read the books that were written circa 1990 and prior, they will explain the sleep paralysis experience without coining a phrase for it. And in fact, many of them will mention it within the context of discussions on vampirism. Or if you go even further back, pre-vampirism, it was more of the Sumerian Lamashtu, Lamia, gods and goddesses, the screech owls, the night demons, the terror by night, the pakkad, things like that. So these things go, they now they're the shadow man. And if you notice too, Paul, one of the things that I found is so interesting is as we advance forward in time, we have this impression that we're getting more educated, more answers, more civilized. But in a sense, the longer we get away from the source of truth, the more generic things get. We have taken actual entities with names, these Pachad demons, the Madai demons, the many demons that are actually mentioned by name in Psalm 91, but people don't recognize it as names. You go back into Babylonian, Akkadian, Sumerian, Egyptian lore, where they're giving actual names to these demons, the Lilith, the Lamia, the Lalitu, all these things. And now, what do we call them? The shadow man, the incubus, the succubus, the hat man. We have relegated an entire hierarchy of spiritual beings down to kindergarten pronoun monikers. Hat man, shadow man. How simplistically naive can you get? These things had actual names. So it's getting dumbed down the further we get. And now they're just shadows, you know? So where sleep paralysis really is a poor term is everyone has sleep paralysis every night, numerous times. There are phases of sleep where we go into deep REM or we're deep sleep phases. The physiology of our body is to shut down. It's so we don't wet the bed. It's so we don't sleepwalk. It's so we don't injure ourselves or act out our dreams. There's nothing phenomenal or supernatural or demonic or paranormal whatsoever about certain times of the night where we are paralyzed. And if we have any sense of consciousness during those times, we will be very aware of the fact that we can't move. And for some people, that might be frightening. So, what we're really talking about when we talk about sleep paralysis, what we're really talking about isn't times in the night when we can't move our body. We're talking about an event that occurs during those phases of sleep where we can't move. This is really smoke and mirrors on behalf of the enemy. They are powerful. But they are not half as powerful as we've been led to believe. And media plays into that with all the horror movies and everything. We believe that these things have so much more power over us than they really do. So we watch Salem's Lot and we think that these vampires just stare at us in the eye and we can't move. No, our bodies are already physiologically, by order of the design of our creator, to shut down. And if they wake us up to spook us, that's a smoke and mirror that they are capitalizing on opportune timing to exacerbate the experience to make it more terrifying. But they're not paralyzing us. That God is doing that. That's part of our body. So when we talk about sleep paralysis, we're talking about the event that can sometimes occur during these times of paralysis. And what a lot of people will Here's the classic experience, but just listeners understand that there are hundreds of experiences of sleep paralysis that fall outside of these parameters. But what you're going to hear most people talk about is an overwhelming sense of dread, soul dread, like fearing that their soul will be lost forever. They will talk about seeing or feeling or sensing a presence in the room that's evil. They will talk about not being able to move, but they'll talk specifically about feeling like they can't breathe, feeling like they're being choked or held down. Some people will even see something. They'll see the apparition on them. They'll talk about shadows and red glowing eyes and alien grays. There's a little bit of an overlap there. And then all the classic little horror movie fodders, the doppelgangers and the little children giggling and all the stuff that the video games and the horror movies love to capitalize on. But that is an entirely different set of characters. The cast of characters that we see in our bedroom as we're coming back into consciousness is a completely different cast of characters than what you see if the sleep paralysis experience escalates into an out of body or an astral experience. Once you are out of your body into the astral, you are no longer dealing with bottom of the totem pole demons and succubuses and things. Up in the astral, you can run into other human beings. You can run into people practicing witchcraft. You can run into familiar spirits, spirit guides, ascended masters. There's all sorts of clutter up there in the astral realm, and those things go beyond demonic entities. And the reason why it's important to know that is, and this is controversial to a lot of people, Paul, and I've had people argue with me, but we have authority over demons because, in a sense, they're kind of like our cousins, right? They have human DNA. They're disembodied spirits of the Nephilim. So they had watcher, DNA, but the mitochondria DNA was from a human woman. So part of the reason why I think they hate us so much is because we are 100% we're 100% of what is 50% diluting them from being the real thing, right? They're not 100% angelic being. They're not 100% spirit being. They've been diluted with this deplorable human DNA, and that's what makes them the weakest in the spirit realm, which is why we have such easy authority over them, because they're like us. When you get up into other realms, you're in the fractal realm, like you've been doing the psychedelics, you're into the ayahuasca, you're in the fractal realm, you're in the astral realm. You are dealing with entities that are now full-blooded. And Jesus gave us authority over the demons. And it's not that we don't have authority over the higher things too, but we have authority over them through Jesus Christ. At that point, we need an advocate. And I have spoken to people, Paul, who have very cockily, thought that because they have such ease over the little shadow people in their bedroom that they can command anything that they want. And we remember from scripture, like the seven spirits of Sceva, when people meddled with the spirit realm and they didn't know what they were doing, they were attacked. And if you don't properly cleanse a person, seven more will come back. And so some of this deliverance stuff, I don't want people to hear me saying that there's not power in the name of Jesus. I don't want to hear people saying that Christians, there's a point where we have our back against the wall and we will be defeated by something, or that the name of Jesus or the power of Jesus can't intervene. But the way that we command demons around in our bedroom and the way we command angelic powers in the spiritual realm, principalities and spiritual forces of darkness, if you approach those beings with the same sort of overconfidence that we can with the demons, which are the bottom of the totem pole, there are people who have gotten to themselves serious mental illnesses and things like that, as a result of toying with things of which they do not know. So that's a very long-winded answer to your question, but I just want everyone to understand from a medical and a scientific and a physiological perspective, I understand that there's nothing magical about sleep paralysis. It happens to every single one of us. What we're talking about when we talk about sleep paralysis is a spiritual visitation that occurs during those times of paralysis.
I'm from a reformed background, so in the reform circles, you've got, see, they go from one extreme to the other. Like, you've got your charismatics who are going around thinking they're casting demons out of everything, and they've got authority, and they've got no. I mean, the King James Version refers to people like that as brute beasts, basically, who are ignorant of these things. And like you were talking about these full-blooded, like, and fallen angels, they're not to be trifled with. I mean, it's not a game. And then you've got other people who, like, within the reform camp, some of them are like, you think, do you believe in anything spiritual? Do you know what I mean? And I've been a Christian since 2001. I've tried to strike the balance. Because, like, I mean, you can see from a bookshelf some of the books I read, like Jonathan Edwards, John Bunyan, Matthew Henry. This is the meat that I'm consuming. But I'm also aware as well of spiritual forces. I know all about spiritual attacks. It's real, and you were talking about obviously the astral realm, and a member of my family. Now, I didn't know what the astral realm were at the time when they were talking to me. I'm going back to 25 years now, and it's interesting that you said that it can happen, because I know there's people who actually look for this type of thing. They sort of practice it or whatever, but it can happen obviously to people who are asleep, because one of my relatives regular as what I know now to be astral projecting, but it always happens when they've gone to sleep. But I mean, they tell me that they like leave the house and everything. And at the time, I just at the time I was like, I couldn't take it on board, because I was a younger man. I was early 20s, and I'd never heard of anything like that before. And obviously, you talk about these. I've heard you talk about the like an ascended master. You mentioned it there. What's an ascended master?
So the actual like Gaia.com glossary definition of an ascended master is a high-ranking guru or being in the astral realm who has achieved ascension. You know, in the Christian realm, we don't really want to talk about ascension because it's like it's not possible to ascend to godhood, right? And it's not possible in the sense that we would mean it. No one's going to become Christ. No one's going to become greater than their master. And no one is going to, like, we're going to have resurrection bodies. And even when we have resurrection bodies, we are never going to be Jesus Christ. We're never going to be God, right? So, but when you look at Nimrod, he was an ordinary man. But through arcane knowledge and probably rituals and black magic and, secret society adept information on probably the pillars that were not destroyed in the flood and found later that developed into modern secret societies and Freemasonry and whatever, which is just sort of shadows of the old blood drinking cults of Kish and the dragon courts and all this wonderful stuff that Gary Wayne can explain so beautifully. Nimrod became a gibbering. He became something more than human. And we know that this is probably possible because they're trying to do it now with all the singularity and transhumanism and sentient AI and all of this stuff, right? So with Nimrod becoming a gibbering, it's the same sort of thing with an ascended master. They were, according to the definition, allegedly, they were human beings who became ascended masters in the same sense that some became gibberimes. Now, this doesn't mean they have eternal life apart from Jesus Christ. This doesn't mean that there's an end to their reign, but apparently there are high levels of the astral realm that, you know, the deplorables and the useless eaters like you and I are never going to get to, nor would we ever wish to ascend there. But there are realms of the astral that only the useful people get to, right? If you're not useful to them, you're never going to see these things. And they know that most people trifling around in the astral realm, they're just like people trifling around on the terrestrial realm. Most people, even some Christians, they're happy with a paycheck every Friday and a widescreen TV and their cell phone and you know. Most human beings are extremely easily pacified with trifles. And it's the same thing in the astral realm. There is like this kindergarten level one base bargain basement version of the astral realm, where you get a little bit of knowledge, or you get a little bit of like goosebumps, or you see a light beam, or you have a little astral orgasm, and that's enough to keep you going the rest of your life. You think you're something really, really special, and you don't even understand that you're literally in the bargain basement. You're never going to see the some of those realms of the astral, and I hope you don't, because the higher you get, the deeper you get, right? So these ascended masters allegedly, and the reason I say allegedly is I do think that the same way Nimrod was able to figure out how to become a Gibreim, I think that there are people in modernity who have figured that out as well. But I also think that there is a lot of subterfuge and a lot of deception, and there's a lot of ascended masters who claim that they were once human because it holds the carrot out to other humans that they can achieve that as well. And it's not that I don't think anyone has ever achieved it, because we know from Nimrod that someone did. But I don't think nearly as many people have achieved it as they would lead us to believe, because they have to dangle that carrot out that if you just keep doing this, and if you keep following this theosophic religion, and if you keep, delving into the dark arts and doing these rituals and learning all this arcane knowledge, that you will get there. The promise is always out there. Like, you'll get there, you'll get there. And the fact of the matter is, very few people will get there. And here's the bad news for the few that do. The biggest promise that they have held out is that if you succeed, you will become as a god, a little g god. You will become as a god. Unfortunately, according to Psalm 82, we figure out the end of the little g gods. We find out that in the very end, when it all hits the fan, the little g gods who were once eternal will die like men. They'll lose their immortality. And so here's the irony of this is why the promise that you will become as gods is not a lie. The part of godhood that you will inherit if you follow this false gospel is that, like the little g gods, you will die like men. That's the part of godhood that they're promising you. Now, if you go off in your own mind thinking I can become like a god means I'll be like Superman and I'll have superpowers and I can read minds and I'll have a Harry Potter wand and I can command things, and if you go off thinking that, great. But that's not what they never explicitly told you that. All they said is you can be as a god. And the trick in that is one day you'll die like men. You're gonna take the fruit and get duped, and you're gonna fall into the same trap we fall, and you're gonna lose your immortality. And in the end, when it's time to be judged, you're gonna die with us. That's the godhood you're inheriting.
It's much bigger than I think Christians realize all this. Like it's like obviously, I mean, it's only recently I've really started to look into this sort of astral projecting and things like that. And I interviewed a pastor from Yuba City in California called Dave Bryan, and he had dealings with Anton LaVey before he died. But well, he
Wow.
actually adopted Anton LaVey's daughter. And it's a wild story, but
I
he
heard
was
of him.
telling me that Anton LaVey actually had security clearance because they had a program within the CIA where people was basically being used as spies because they could astral project, and they could
Remote
like
viewing.
astral remote viewing, and I was just astounded by it. But I think that Christians need to sort of realize that it's not just black and white. There's demons and then there's good angels and that's it. There's all these other things going on, like you mentioned, the screech owl. And I know I had Jud Burton on here, and I was on about the screech owl, and I said that obviously in the King James Version that's what it's translated as, but that's actually Lilith, isn't it, or Lilith, which is related to sort of vampirism. And but obviously we've talked, obviously, it's sleep paralysis, but we know that that's like sort of an incorrect term, really. But what doorways sort of can lead people into this? Because obviously we know like the common ones, like people's done Ouija boards or they've done acid and all that type of stuff. But what other doorways can sort of lead people into, being involved with this quote unquote sleep paralysis?
Yep. I'm so glad that you just used the word doorway. You can call it a liminal space. You can call it a portal, a wormhole, a door, a gate, or you can call it a threshold. Now, I talk about thresholds in my book in chapter four, Astral Vampires and Threshold Covenants. Now, I have talked about this on so many podcasts that all anyone would have to do to hear about the more vampiric aspects of that, or the common doors that you can open. We all know the obvious ones, right? But because know that my listenership here is Christians, I'm gonna share something with you that I've never gone into depth in I believe any podcast, because we all know the obvious stuff, right? Everybody who writes to me with sleep paralysis, they self-diagnose themselves. Well, I played with the Ouija board once in high school, and I smoked pot for 3 years, and I slept with a guy I wasn't married to. Like, everybody self-diagnoses because everyone knows by nature the things that they should and shouldn't be doing. And so, but let me explain it for a deeper audience of people who are walking with the Lord. Hey, I'm not just one of these Christians that pray to prayer in youth group and go to church and think I'm saved because of that. I'm going to give a deeply, profoundly theological answer to that question with what opens the doorway. Jesus Christ said, I am the door. The most profound metaphor of a doorway in scripture is Passover. And the way that the Israelites escaped death and their firstborn were not killed is they painted all the lintels of their door. Their whole door would have been painted in blood. Jesus said, I'm the door. And if you remember in the Old Testament, the way that the priests were consecrated is that blood, the blood of the sacrifice, a thumb was dipped in it, and they would touch the earlobes and various parts of the body. What they were doing is they were putting a border around that body, so like all four corners of the body were dipped in blood. The priest was being consecrated the same way the door was being consecrated, with blood at all the corners. When Jesus was on the cross, he had a crown of thorns. Both his hands and his feet were dipped in blood because those were the points where the blood was gushing out with the nails and the crown. He's the door. He's being stretched out, and there's blood over all four of the doorposts, right? It's a threshold. There's tons of stuff in the Old Testament that talk about the cultural traditions of these hospitality rituals of the threshold covenants, where you would slaughter an animal and you would put the blood at the basin, and your guest would step over the threshold. And once he stepped over the threshold, you were in covenant with that person. It talked about the disrespect and the dishonor. If you trampled on someone's threshold, you were dishonoring that family. You were breaking the covenant. But furthermore, it was actually a threat against them. So, where all this comes into play is sleep paralysis. It's a threshold covenant. These entities are coming to a liminal space, which is usually our bedroom door, because that's where a lot of people see these entities. They're coming to the door like a vampire. They're looking for that invitation. They can't cross over the threshold without the invitation. And this is the $64,000 question for Christians. What am I doing to invite this thing over the door? And you hear everything from, I've prayed all of these prayers against anything that could have happened in my ancestry or in my bloodline. I prayed over all of the, thresholds and the corners of my property. I've gotten rid of everything in my house that I think could be an offense to God, and I don't listen to rock music, and I got rid of all my movies, and I mean, you hear all this stuff. And then there's people that still struggle with it. So what that means is there is some area in our life where we have trampled on that threshold, where Jesus spread the blood on the threshold of his dwelling place. We see this in Psalm 91, verse 9, because I have made Yahweh my dwelling place, no evil shall befall me, no plague will come near my tent. He'll charge his angels over me. I'll tread on the lion and the serpent. Those promises are for people who have made Yahweh their dwelling place, which means when he put the blood, his own blood, on the threshold and invited us to come into his house. We see this in Revelation 3:20 as well. When we step over that threshold, we're in covenant with him. We trample on the threshold. When we think that Jesus is a revolving door instead of a door. And the problem that most of us Christians have isn't that we didn't pray a prayer to receive Christ, or that we don't go to church, or that, we don't do all these things. But when we fall out of covenant with Jesus, what we're doing is we're stepping back over that threshold, back out into the world. We're trying to have one foot here, one foot in. We want all of his protection and his blessings and his mercy and his safety. But we really are kind of intrigued with what's going on outside of the tent too. So I think that the reason why a lot of Christians have so much spiritual warfare, we have a lot of flattering explanations for that. Oh, you're a prayer warrior, so you've got a target on your back. We all think that the devil's after us because we're doing so much damage, And it's not that there aren't people out there that aren't doing damage, but what's happening is the enemy can only get us when we've left the tent. Because when we're inside the tent of Jehovah, he's the doorkeeper and nothing gets past him. So if warfare is hitting us, it's either getting inside the tent, so it is the will of God because he's strengthening our faith, or he's wants to, us to bear fruit, or he's teaching us warfare. Or the more probable explanation for most of us is that we've trampled that threshold. He shed his own blood. We stepped over it. We covenanted with him. But then as soon as something sort of thrilling is happening on the outside of the tent, we are leaping back over that threshold outside of that protective tent. And we're becoming enamored with the world. We are giving in to the flesh. And when I say that, I don't just mean everybody, because it's the culture we live in now. Anytime you talk about sin or temptation or the flesh or a besetting sin, everybody always assumes it's sex or it's pornography or it's masturbation or it's sleeping around. And there are a million ways to give in to the flesh that have nothing to do with sex. There's all sorts of appetites out there and besetting sins, et cetera, et cetera. So I don't want people to hear that, well, hey, if I'm a virgin and I don't sleep around and I don't look at porn, I don't have to worry about any of this stuff. There are so many ways to leave the tent and trample the threshold. So I wouldn't say this on most of my podcasts, because a lot of the podcasts that I'm on, I'm dealing with people who are not in the fold at all. They're brand new Christians. They're like, I'm talking now to people who've been walking with the Lord for 20, 30, 40 years, who have read the Bunyans and the Edwards and who've been raised in church. Why am I being attacked like this? The reason you're being attacked like this is because when Jesus says, "Behold, I stand at the door and knock. If anyone hears my voice and opens the door and lets me in," what you don't understand is at that point when he gets let in, that door gets permanently locked until his second coming. It becomes a storm shelter. It becomes a bomb shelter. And you take the deed of that house and you sign it over to him, and it becomes his house. And anytime anything knocks on that door stays locked. And because of, I don't know how it's like overseas, but here in America, the trend of evangelicalism is grace, 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 right? The way grace is being misunderstood in the American church, to apply to this metaphor, grace means that the door is unlocked and there's a welcome mat. And even though I've invited Jesus in and he's there when I need him, anytime anything wants to come in, the door's unlocked and there's a welcome mat. That's not what grace is. Grace isn't covering our sin. Grace is enabling us to rise above it and to hate it so much that we don't want to do it anymore. That's grace. And that's the difference between Old Testament Day of Atonement and New Testament forgiveness of sins. In the Old Testament, one day a year, they celebrated the Day of Atonement, and it was a day of great fast. And that was the day where the priest would go into the Holy of Holies once a year, and one wrong move and he was dead, right? The people feared that day because God might say, "No, I don't forgive your sins. You're not contrite. Your fasting is just all ritual. You don't love me." And so it was a very sober day. But in the Old Testament times, pre-Christ, the Day of Atonement was a covering up of the sin, much in the same way that the sin of Adam and Eve, their nakedness had to be covered, right? It was covered with the animal skin. When Jesus came and the temple veil was torn in two, Jesus doesn't cover our sins anymore. He takes them away. He takes them away. So grace isn't, "I didn't see that. I didn't see that. I didn't see that." Grace is, "I am going to assist you in loving me so much that you don't even want to do that stuff anymore. It won't even appeal to you. You're going to become a new person." So it's a long, probably unsatisfying answer to someone who just wants to hear about the shadow man and aliens and cryptids and, goosebump stories, right? But for those of us who have walked with the Lord for a very long time, if you've got entities showing up in your bedroom, they have permission. They are there because legal permission has been given to them. And we have to learn how to clean our houses, get Jesus back over that threshold, and get that door locked. And so there are exceptions. Everybody wants to be the one Job in the Sea of Peters, right? We all want to be that one guy that's being persecuted because we are so righteous. And there are people like that. There are people that are undergoing sleep paralysis right now because they're being trained for war. It's the bear and the lion that David had to kill with his bare hands before he killed Goliath. There are people going through sleep paralysis because they're being trained for war. But to that, if that's your category, to you, I would say what Jesus said when the 70 came back, enamored with the fact that they had the power over the demons. And Jesus said, "Do not rejoice that the demons, you have authority over the demons. Rejoice that your name is written in the book of life, and that you have a place in eternity with me. So for 1% of you, the sleep paralysis might not go away because you might be getting trained for war. You're going to be a warrior in the last days, and you have to not be afraid of these things. You have to know before you pick up those five stones to slay the giant that I have tested my armor, and I've killed a bear and a lion before this. But for the other 99% of us who aren't Job and aren't King David, if something's coming over your threshold every night, you got to figure out how they got that invitation. And you need to revoke that invitation by bringing Jesus over the threshold and signing the deed of your home, your heart, your life, your heart, your soul, your mind, your body over to the new owner. And you let that door get locked, and you let Jesus be the doorkeeper.
Yeah. I mean, it is like you said, you know, everyone always goes, oh, I'm sleeping around, or it's the pornography thing. But what I would say to people is, it's not always what you're doing. It's what you're not doing. Your sins of
Amen.
Omission.
Yeah.
You know, no one talks about that. And it's like, you know, what I think one of the biggest things what people overlook is self-centeredness and selfishness. You know, they focus on the other things what we were talking about, but they don't look at other areas of their life where they're being selfish all the time, because we're all selfish to a certain degree, some more than others. But one of the topics I've heard you talk about on some of the podcasts I've listened to is the Asclepions.
Mm-hmm.
Could you tell us a little bit about them for those who don't know who they are and what that's all about? I found it interesting when I heard you talk about it.
Yes, I love this. I think this is maybe chapter two in the book. I love getting to talk about this because so many of the shows I'm on, they focus on the vampires and the thresholds and the shadow people, right? The Asclepions, and this falls in line perfectly with the quote from the book that you read earlier, and that is that there's been this bitter divorce in modern day between the paranormal and the, you know, the medicine and the science and the supernatural and the spiritual. Back in the first century, when Jesus was on earth, and in the second century, there prevailed what was called the Asclepions. And this was very prevalent in both Greek and Roman culture. And if you know the context and the culture of the New Testament, the pool that all of the sick people wanted to go into because it would heal them, that very likely was an Asclepion, because an Asclepion was a temple, but it was also a hospital, a gymnasium, a theater. It was many things, and they had these healing pools outside. What I think is really interesting is a lot of the times that Jesus healed people, he healed on the Sabbath because he was trying to make a point, right? And so a lot of times when he did healing, it was the Sabbath day. This should be controversial. If we as believers understood the culture and the context of much of the Bible, we would be offended at every corner, because Jesus was constantly doing things that if he did them in modern day, we'd be like, Jesus, what were you doing there? You know? Jesus is hanging around on the Sabbath day at these pagan temples. That's where he was at. And he was healing these people that were going to the wrong source of healing. And he was basically displaying his power of healing in the very face of these false gods. And so you really do see Jesus's kind of snarky sense of humor when you say, like, well, what am I going to do today? I'm going to go over to the pagan hospitals and heal all these people that they couldn't heal, right? So these Asclepions were temples to the god Asclepios. Asclepios was the serpent god of healing. And the rod of Asclepios, I don't know if this is prevalent overseas, but here in America, you see the rod of Asclepios on every ambulance, our medical facilities, on prescription pads, hospital door windows. It's the one pole with the one serpent twined up around
Yeah.
it.
I seen it
It's
when I was in army. The medics, they had it on the cap badge, I believe. That's where I've seen it anyway.
exactly. That is a rod of Asclepius, the serpent god of healing. Not to be confused with the caduceus, which is the winged pole with the two snakes going up it. That has to do with Mercury and Hermesthigistes. I can never say that, but that's got all that Hermes and all that stuff. So the original Hippocratic Oath was written in Greek. And if you read the Greek version and the translation of the Greek version, which you can still find online easily, the opening line is that you're pledging, you are covenanting, you are entering into an oath with Apollo, Asclepius, Pangaea, Pansea, and Hygieia. This is a family, okay? Apollo was a god, little g god, right? A watcher, a titan. To the Greek, he was probably a titan. Apollo had a human wife, go figure, right? So all of his children, Asclepius, Pansea, and Hygieia, were Nephilim. They were demigods. They had watcher father blood, and they had human mother blood. They were all gods and goddesses over various healing, like Hygieia. And you can almost hear modern Latin and English words out of that, like hygiene, and like there's different health kind of connotations to all of them. So anyway, Asclepius was the serpent god of healing. Now, when you get into the second century, this is where Galen comes onto the scene. And Galen was the super surgeon of the second century. He's probably the most famous of all of the surgeons of antiquity. And much of the medical field, all the way into the 18 and 1900s, and even some of what's still around today, was influenced by his observations and his books and the things that he discovered. But guess what? Watcher technology. He learned much of what he learned in the astral realm. Because what Galen did and what would happen in these Asclepions is you would dream a cure. If you were even let into an Asclepion, because there were rigid rules, much like today, there are certain people that are denied health care. There's certain rules that you have to meet before you can be let into a hospital. And there's even more now since 2020. They won't let you in unless you play by the rules. Same thing back then, nothing new under the sun. The most interesting thing to note is that they would never let in a pregnant woman or an elderly person because they didn't want to risk having any death within the Asclepion. It was bad for business. So you look today at the two most neglected in healthcare, the two most unappreciated, unworthy of medical assistance is the elderly and the unborn, right? That goes all the way back to Asclepius, the servant god of healing. If you're rich enough and you're good enough for the club, we'll heal you, right? If you can pay us in gold when we're done, you can come in. Or if your insurance will cover it, we'll let you in. Same, it's all the same. So if you got let in, you would, in preparation for your healing, like just think about this. You had to be in a certain state of mind if you were going to be able to astral project. Kind of like nowadays, you know how they say that you can't be hypnotized if you don't want to be, or if you don't believe it, or if you resist it. You have to have that permission. You have to have that invitation. You cannot cross over these thresholds, and they can't cross over these thresholds to us unless we expressly permit them to do so. So when these people came into the Asclepions, they had to be prepared to be in the right frame of mind to basically astral project. So before any of the actual, any medical treatment was given to them, think about this. Think about what we do today when we don't feel good or they were entertained for days on end. There was a theater in the Asclepion, and they would go to these performances and watch the plays. There's something about entertainment that lulls people into relaxation and into different states of mind and different brain waves. And, they didn't exactly have flicker rates and blue lights and things like that back in those days. But they knew then, as they know now, that in certain states of relaxation, your brain waves switch off from sober-minded and vigilant to just passive. So the very first part of your medical treatment was to be pacified through entertainment, lulled into a slower state of mind. Then, when you passed that test and they decided, okay, you're a good candidate for this. You would be heavily sedated. You'd be high as a kite. They would have some sort of herbal mixture, something very similar to ayahuasca, I would assume. And then they would take you underground into the catacombs, where you would wander around in the dark in circles for hours, so that you were completely disoriented. You didn't know where you were. The medicine has kicked in now. You are thoroughly under the spell and under really basically hypnosis. When you're in those states, you're highly suggestible. So when all of that was done, you were brought to your quarters for the night, which was an underground catacomb where you would sleep on the ground with all the other people. And then they would open up the chests, and the snakes would crawl all over you all night. And just think about being half asleep, half awake, in an altered state of consciousness, confused, you're in the dark, you don't really know where you are. Plus, you're heavily sedated. I don't know if you ever come out of anesthesia or if you've ever even just had too much NyQuil. When you come out of some of these, you don't know what's real, and you don't know if you're awake or not. And I just imagine the state of absolute confusion these people must have been in by the time it was said and done. Now you got these snakes crawling all over you. At this point, they would. If it was successful, they would astral project. And they would talk to entities up in the spirit realm, spirit guides, familiar spirits. And because these entities were smart, they have more knowledge than we do, and because they wanted to be mistaken as God and they wanted to be worshiped, they were smart enough in many cases to give an actual cure. Which many times those cures were ahead of their time. There were things that had evaded discovery in the real world. Real doctors didn't know. That's why I'm telling you, a lot of people, they don't understand this. A lot of the medical procedures that we have to this day were discovered in the astral realm by entities who had that. It's the mysteries of heaven. It's Book of Enoch stuff. They're still sharing with us these mysteries of heaven and this arcane knowledge. And God has worked some of it for good. Lives are being saved in the medical profession. I'm not a Christian scientist. I owe a lot to, I had surgeons. I had surgeries for the first 15 years of my life. And I owe a lot to those doctors who cared for me. So don't hear me, throwing the baby out with the bathwater here, but the fact is that these people were so desperate to be cured that they were selling their souls. because they were contracting with evil spirits to get the cure. And this is where Antipas got into trouble. We learn in Revelation that Antipas, the faithful martyr, who interestingly was in Pergamum, which is where one of the largest Asclepions to ever exist was. And I believe, but don't quote me on this, I believe that's where Galen was. Pergamum is the seat of Satan. Antipas was killed. Antipas was a disciple of John. And Antipas, basically, talk about guts. Antipas moves into Pergamum, the seat of Satan, where this massive Asclepion is, where demons are curing people in the astral realm for large amounts of money, right? Bottom line, big pharma. It was big pharma, the second century. This guy has got the guts because of his faith in God and his anointing, right under the nose of Zeus, sets up his shingle and starts healing people in the name of Jesus for free. So if you wonder why Antipas was martyred, it was because he brought down big pharma and they couldn't have that. So it's really interesting to know the history of some of this stuff because I think a lot of people are thrown into confusion since 2020. And we're like, this is so evil. Where did this come from? It must be the end because look at how evil things have gotten. And people are going against the Hippocratic Oath because they're euthanizing people and aborting babies. They're not going against the Hippocratic Oath. And you can change the words in English and say, like, I'm swearing to God or whatever, but that original, the spirit of that Hippocratic Oath was that you are covenanting with demigods who are going to give you knowledge on how to heal your patients. So there's nothing new under the sun. And what we're seeing today is just a shadow of the roots of these things. And it's important. I want to just stress it again. I'm not saying that if you go to a hospital, you don't have faith and you should, please don't take my words and go 10 more miles down the road with it. I'm just telling you that it's important for us to understand the roots of where we are today so that we're not so many of us think that we're so much further down the road now because things have gotten so evil and we sort of romanticize the past. What's happening to us today has been happening for thousands of years. It's not new and it's not something that God, Jehovah Rapha, cannot handle. And that's just, I'll close with this, Paul, because it's such a cool antidote. We have gotten accustomed to saying that Jesus is the great physician. That's technically nowhere in scripture. What it says in scripture is they call him Jehovah Rapha, which is Hebrew for God our healer. The great physician or the divine physician is what it's the title that had been given to Asclepius, the serpent god of healing. His moniker was the divine physician. So I try to correct myself because, oh, believe me, I've said great physician a bazillion times. I'm like I said, I spent the first 15 years of my life in the hospital. I can't even tell you how many times the great physician was called upon. But now, it just knowing the background of where that came from, I know Jesus knows our heart, and he's not up there going, "I'm not the great physician." But I just want people to understand that phrase, the great physician, the divine physician, it was originally attributed to a Nephilim. And our God is greater than that. And our God deserves a greater title than we give demons. And he is our healer. And so as things get rough and we start hearing about disease X and all this nonsense, we are going to have to, like never before, we as a church are going to have to understand that our primary care physician first and foremost is Jesus Christ, and any hospital that we go to is the second opinion.
I actually read the original oath of the Hippocratic Oath, and apparently this is the original oath. I'm just going to read the first three sort of sentences, and this was apparently what they used to say up until 1964. Apparently they've changed it now, but like you said, I mean, it says, "I swear by Apollo the healer, by Asclepios, by Hygieia, by Panacea, and by all the gods and goddesses, making them my witnesses, that I will carry out, according to my ability and judgment, this oath and this indenture." I mean, most people won't have a clue that that's it. I mean, so it's not even, it's naming these, some of these gods and Nephilim, and then it says all as well, all the gods and goddesses. I mean, I was stunned when I read that myself.
Me too.
And apparently, that's the one that they used up till 1964. That's what the source that I read said that, and then they added like a different version of it now. But just in sort of closing, I did say to you, I was going to talk to you a little bit about my own experiences.
Yeah.
So what I'll do, I'll give a little bit of my background, and maybe, I don't know whether that'll lead you to be able to say, well, that's the reason or whatever. But I mean, basically, I've been a Christian since 2001, but my parents weren't Christians. I think my mother first professed faith. She was originally brought up, well, she went to a Methodist school. My dad was a Roman Catholic. He professed faith later than my mum. I think late 80s. So I got taken to church and everything like that. But then I went away from it all, smoking cannabis, drinking, Ouija board, blah, 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 all that rubbish. So when I was, let me see, I think I was 18. This is before, like I said, this is about 3 years, 2, 3 years before I became a Christian. I was living with a girl. I lived in a flat. There was a gentleman who lived downstairs and we lived upstairs. It was like a shared accommodation. And this isn't the first time. This isn't like my first experience. I have one that I'll talk about secondly, where I was a lot younger, but this one is the most recent one. So it would have been about the late 90s. And basically, I remember being lay in bed, obviously paralyzed. But the first time this happened, I had sort of slightly more movement than the second time I remember it. But what I noticed were at the bottom of my bed was a black mist. And I felt that it was an evil presence in the room, but the mist began to move upwards from the base of my bed and just kept coming closer and closer. And obviously, I became more and more frightened, panicking. Now, the first instance, I felt like I could lift my head. And it's strange because it ended. But it seemed like it went on for such a long time. But after it ended, and I've thought back over the years, I thought, was it even that long? But I remember the terror, like the terror was real. And obviously after that, I'm thinking, did I really see that? Did I see that mist? So it happened the second time, but the second time, the mist, it started again, but it was bigger and it came further up. But this time, I couldn't move at all. It was literally like I could only move my eyes. So I was laying in bed, like a couple of pillows, so I could, but I just couldn't move. And I remember at this point, I was trying to move, but the same sense of fear. But this time it was more like something's going to happen. Like the first time I was fearful, but the second time it was like that this, whatever it was, had more intent. And that them are the sort of last two episodes that I had that I remember. And I was, like I said, about 18 or 19. But the strangest one, which I don't really talk about, is I think I was about 8 years old. And one of the odd things about it is that I remember, so in my room was exactly the same as I remember it. The only difference was that there was another bed, but I didn't, that bed wasn't there. And on the bed, there used to be an old lady who used to look at me with black eyes. But she used to try and tell me that she was my grandma. And I just remember she used to intently stare at me. And it was so creepy, but I could move, but she was in the room. And that was like one of them that was like, I mean, obviously I was 8 years old. So I've gone over this multiple times over the years, but it's only recently that I've thought I actually did see something. Like, 'cause I used to think, well, it was just like a nightmare. What? But I mean, have you heard anything along them lines regarding like the old lady? I mean, you must have heard. I'm assuming you've heard like about the mist type thing.
So the old lady, it can be one of two or three things. Sometimes the old lady presents herself as an old lady and stays an old lady. Sometimes the old lady is familiar to the child and it actually is a grandmother or it's a relative that they might not recognize, but then they see the picture in the photo album, that kind of a thing, right? So in that case, it's usually a familiar spirit. But then the third iteration of the old lady is that she initially presents herself as a beautiful woman, as a seductress. And then when the person is a little too far down the line, she changes, she metamorphoses into the old woman. And the classic example we have of this is in The Shining, the Stephen King movie, The Shining, where he's in the room and he's, kissing the beautiful woman, and then he catches wind of her in the vanity mirror and she turns into an old woman and starts laughing. That's kind of the classic, succubus kind of a story. So, but the old woman is very familiar. Usually when people tell me about the old woman, she's in a rocking chair, which this is the part that blows me away. And it's probably what you're thinking about too, Paul, with like the bed. Like sometimes the props, like it's like, okay, I understand if an entity is appearing to me, but why did they bring furniture with them? Like, where did these props come from? Like, why is she in a bed that's not there? And like, why do so many people see her in a rocking chair? And it's always very specific, like what they're wearing. And they almost always are wearing something that's out of date. And I don't know if that's to appear more gothic or whatever, because like I have never to this point had someone tell me an entity showed up in my room wearing a pair of jeans and a t-shirt. Like I've never heard that, right? So maybe they would think that that would be too comical and they wouldn't be taken seriously. Maybe that wouldn't be scary, but the one point in your story that I think it is really valid, and I really want people who have had numerous sleep paralysis experiences and who are probably going to have more of them. I know it's very hard to be an observer during these times because we're usually using all of our brain power on getting ourselves awake or getting out of that situation. And so it's very hard to kind of sit there and give a look around the room. And sometimes people, when they come to, they don't remember a lot of the experience. But when you've had the experience repeatedly, you will always note a glitch. So we all believe that we've woken up in our rooms and that our eyes are open and we can move our eyes, but we can't move anything else. But we're in our room. And we believe that we're in our room because everything looks the way it should. You know, our point of view is the same. And if you're in a hotel, you're seeing the hotel room. If you're taking a nap in the living room, you're seeing the living room. And so we will conclude without really observing the scenario that I'm awake because I'm looking at my room. What took me a long time to figure out, because it took me a long time to control my fear, is there's always a glitch. There's something in your room that's not really there. It can be one time I had these like full length mirrors on the wall that I don't have in real life. Another time the door was completely on the wrong wall. One time I was on a big overstuffed chair, but in real life it was a couch. And but it was the same fabric, same color, same everything. They get it like 99% right. And I don't know if it's not always right because they can't get it right, or if this is one of those kind of occult rules of we have to let it out of the bag so then it's your fault because you didn't notice. Like, I don't know if it's one of those sorts of things, but I just remember sort of noting at times that, like, oh, wait, I should have known that that I was asleep because that door isn't on the right wall or this or that. And it wasn't until I saw the first Matrix movie where he's in the jump space in the hotel and they're about to go up the spiral staircase, which all sorts of massive astral projection, predictive programming in that movie, the spiral staircase. You know, you got the Fibonacci sequence and you're going up and everything. Every time he's in the Matrix, everything's green and everything. He doesn't see Trinity, the familiar, unless he's in the Matrix. When he sees the cat and it's explained to him that it's a glitch, it made sense to me all of a sudden. There's always a glitch in these experiences, in the dream world, in the Matrix, whatever you want to call it. Even Morpheus, who's the main character, Morpheus was the Greek god of the dream world. He was the god of dreams, you know? He leads Neo up to the Oracle's door, the threshold, right? And he says, I can't go any further. He wasn't allowed over the threshold. But Neo had a choice and chose to go over that threshold. And as soon as he gets over that threshold, everything's green. She's in this green kitchen, right? So all of this is astral. And what they gave away in that movie is that when you're in that jump space, when you're in that, you know, dream place, there's always a glitch if you look for it. If you notice that black cat, if you notice that loop, if you notice that door on the wrong wall, and this is an indication you are not awake in your bedroom. You're not there. You are in a simulation of your room. You are out of your body. And I don't know if it's a trick of the third eye, like the mind's eye, if they're overlaying it. I don't know if they're, because I doubt they're up there recreating your bedroom, right? So it's some trick of the mind, some sort of a hallucinatory thing. But this is another reason why I think a lot of people can't get to the bottom of what's really happening with the sleep paralysis agenda is they think that they're waking up and seeing this thing in their bedroom. And it's really hard to argue with someone who's had sleep paralysis who believes that that's what's happening because that's all that they can read on the internet. That's what is being told is happening to you. But if you can find these glitch, if you can find the glitch, you can't account for the fact that when you woke up in the middle of the night, the door to your bedroom is on the wrong wall. And then it's not there anymore when you wake up. And a little word on that too. And this is just a theory of mine. This is just a theory of mine. Why is 3 a.m. the witching? Why is that the witching hour? Why do so many people say that this happens at 3 in the morning? And it can happen at midnight. I've woken up from sleep paralysis experiences, you know, and it's 9 a.m. It's like there's nothing super magic about 3 a.m., but a lot of people talk about 3 a.m. as the witching hour. And they talk about, well, that's when rituals are being done or whatever, but why 3 a.m.? And this is just a guess. But the enemy likes to copy and mock everything that God or Jesus does. Like they take everything from the Bible and they turn it on its head and they mock it. When Jesus Christ died, when he gave up his spirit and he died, the temple veil was torn in two, meaning that wall that once existed between man and God, that wall got torn down, that the veil between the spiritual and the terrestrial realm were now thinner. The communication we now had with God was going to be direct. Jesus gave up his spirit at 3 p.m., if you do the math in the scripture. And my little theory is that the enemy picked 3 a.m. as a forgery of, okay, you thin the veil at 3 p.m., we'll thin it at 3 a.m. Just a theory, because a lot of people are super freaked out that every time they wake up, it's 3 a.m. And that can make the experience scary too, when every time you wake up with this, you look at the clock and it's the same time. It's just another contrivance of the enemy to kind of up the ante of that fear factor. But again, a lot of the information that we're getting on the internet about this experience is really a bunch of foo-foo. And to get to the bottom of our experience, why am I being attacked? Why am I vulnerable? Why can't I get rid of it? What's the open door? What's the source of this? Where am I when this is happening? The internet is not going to solve these questions for us. And I realize the irony of being on the internet telling people this, but what I'm telling you is, you have to seek God in prayer. And his spirit has to reveal to you through prayer, through diligence, through obedience, through worship, through fasting, to get to the source. Is it a door you opened? Is it sin? Maybe, but maybe it's ancestral. Maybe it's a bloodline thing. Maybe it has to do with where you're living or the previous owners. Maybe there's charged objects. Maybe there is someone practicing witchcraft in your neighborhood or at your workplace that you ticked off. Some of these sleep paralysis experiences are actually human beings, remote viewing in your room. And you can tell the difference between the demons and the witches that come in, because a lot of times the witches, they look exactly like the coworker or the neighbor, and you can see them. So there's too many tentacles to this to just sweep it under the carpet and decide not to deal with it. There's too many tentacles to figure it out by going to a secular website and getting all of their disinformation. And there's too many tentacles to listen to a really good Christian podcast with someone who's trying to steer you in the right direction and who's been there herself. Ultimately, a spiritual door got opened, and you can find out who, when, where, why, and how that got opened, and you can get that door shut. But it's going to take diligence. There's no quick, easy fix there, Even my book isn't going to be like, okay, this is a formula, one, two, three, and now it's gone. My book is hopefully a tool of encouragement to get you to start taking this seriously and to start partnering with God to get to the bottom of it.
Yeah. It's interesting when you mentioned then about like the area in which you live. And I don't live where I grew up now. I moved to North, I live in Wales now, but I'm from northwest of England. And the county that I'm from is a county called Lancashire. And Jud Burton actually knows about it, surprisingly. We're going to do an episode on it because it's a well-known area for witchcraft. So the east of the county, like even to the point where when I was in the Cubs, our badge that we had on our left arm was a witch on a broom.
No way.
It's a massive area for witchcraft, East Lancashire, and a place called Pendle Hill. I think there's been a film done about it, but it's so maybe like. Maybe that's got something to do with it. I don't know, but there's a lot of people practice it. I mean, obviously, it plays out in things like you can see, like it's a big area for sort of drink, drugs, single parent families. There's all kinds of crime. That's one of the reasons we moved. But like I said, it's like got a tradition of witchcraft. Because before coming on and speaking to you, that's one of the things that's been going over in my mind. Maybe that had something to do with it. But like I said, I can't put my finger on it. But it's been wonderful talking to you anyway. Just for my listeners then, could you just sort of tell us where they can get hold of your book and if they could where they can contact you? Because I know you've got a website and everything.
Yeah, absolutely. So my website, VickiJoyAnderson.com, and that's Vicky is Vicki. Everything is on there. You can get to my Instagram from there. You can get to my books from there. You can contact me from there. My book is exclusively on LAMarzulli.net. You can go there directly, or you can go to my site. It's not on Amazon or any of that stuff. You're only going to find it on LA's site. So, yeah, VickiJoyAnderson.com. My Instagram is VickiJoyAuthor. And if you contact me through Instagram or through my website, I'm more than happy to talk to people. I do phone calls, like counseling phone calls. I don't take calls to just like talk about, hey, I had this cool, this happened to me once, you know, but I do the calls with people who are really in the throes of warfare and are not sleeping and are being targeted, et cetera, et cetera. So please feel free to send me your questions or you know your thoughts on this. This is a collective conversation between everybody who is experiencing this. And I every time I talk to someone, every time I get an email, I learn something. So it's a two-way street here.
It's a crazy topic. Like, I mean, just for people who don't know me and you've heard me tell me stories of sleep paralysis, and you're thinking, he had an old lady in his room. This guy's crazy. Listen, my background in church, right? I do not go to a charismatic church. I don't speak in tongues. I'm not going around laying my hands on people, all this type of stuff. Yeah. I'm from a reformed background, but I can assure you these things, what I was telling you, they happened to me. And it's not something I go around talking about all the time, but it's been a great episode. I've been looking forward to speaking to you, Vicky. Like I said, because I do episodes with people, and it's great. I talk about all kinds of interesting topics, but it's rare. Like I talk about something that I've experienced myself, and this is one for me as well as my audience. Like guys, definitely if you're experiencing anything like this, Vicky's the person to speak to. She has obviously been so. Going through it herself and researching it for a lot of years now, and she spoke to a lot of different people. So thanks again, Vicky. Guys, I'll be back next week with another guest. If you're enjoying the show, you can follow me on wherever you listen to your podcasts. So I'm Paul, and this is Beyond the Paradigm.
Am I crazy? We don't use that word in here.